Good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is Marino versus City of Gehring. Both sides have up to 15 minutes to argue. Mr. Campbell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Charles Campbell. I represent one of the co-appellants in this case, Scotts Bluff County. Howard Olson represents the other co-appellant, City of Gehring. We will split our argument. I will plan our first 10 minutes. I will address the issue of the district court's denial of our motion to compel discovery, and Mr. Olson will discuss whether the court erred in finding that the plaintiff met her burden to prove that the disfusion surgery that was performed on the plaintiff was necessary to treat her for injury sustained in the accident. The main issue at trial was about the credibility of the plaintiff's neurosurgeon, Dr. Omar Jimenez, who testified that a three-level disfusion operation was necessary to treat the plaintiff for injury caused by the accident. The medical records and the plaintiff's own testimony undercut Dr. Jimenez's opinion. This evidence is outlined on pages 14 to 24 of our brief. It showed that the plaintiff did not have symptoms that would justify the operation. Ms. Moreno testified that she only agreed to the operation because Dr. Jimenez told her that if she didn't have it, that she would lose the ability to walk.
Before you continue discussing the merits, the appellee has suggested that we lack jurisdiction of this issue because you didn't pursue some mandamus or interlocutory sort of appeal.
Right.
What's your view of that?
General rule on appeals from rulings on discovery orders is that the appeal cannot be had until after final judgment is entered, unless the remedy is adequate. We're not claiming that you can't enter a remedy that would be adequate to address the problems that occurred with this ruling. So mandamus wouldn't be appropriate and the interlocutory appeal.
Thank you.
The plaintiff's daughter-in-law also confirmed that Dr. Jimenez told her that she would be paralyzed, would be unable to walk if she didn't undergo the operation. The operation didn't help Ms. Moreno, but only made her worse. She testified she was much worse after the operation than she was before it, and she continued to have the same symptoms after the surgery that she had before the operation, because the operation simply didn't address those problems. 3 months before trial, we learned about reports that were recently published online by CBS News that discussed the study of neurosurgeons who were performing excessive and unnecessary spinal fusion operations. The article noted that these operations had become quite controversial and were potentially dangerous. Featured several doctors in the article. Dr. Jimenez was one of the neurosurgeons that the article primarily featured and focused upon. It stated that during the two-year period in question that included the date of the operation on Ms. Moreno, that Dr. Jimenez performed 325 spinal disc fusion operations, which was the third most in the country. Of course, as the article points out, these operations produce a lot of revenue for the surgeon and the medical facility.
What did the district court say about your ability to find out that information?
District Judge made a comment in approximately one sentence to the effect that it can be assumed that the information contained in the report was available to the public. The problem with that conclusion is that, as the report stated, the investigators for CBS News obtained exclusive access to Medicare data that was not available to the general public. And further, once obtaining that data, they then translated codes so that that information could be readily understood, and then calculated it, disseminated it for each physician. So we simply didn't have the ability or opportunity to obtain that information, nor did any other.
What is it? Why Why is it that CVS had some special privilege that was not available to you all?
The article didn't go into detail as to how they did that. I do not know mechanics of how they got this information, what they did. We simply learned about it on the eve of the trial, and that's when we became aware of this. We didn't have this information at the time that we took his deposition nearly a year before trial. And of course, we're not able to ask him about these other disfusion operations that he performed.
Dr. Jimenez was never a party and was never sought to be added as a party to this litigation?
No, he never was. There was no cross-claim against him for malpractice.
And the district judge characterized this evidence as character evidence. Do you agree with that characterization?
No, and that really goes to the heart of my argument. We argued on our motion to compel that the need for the evidence, or the information, not evidence, was to allow us to prepare to conduct an effective cross-examination and potentially impeach his opinion testimony. The district judge didn't even comment on the purpose for our requesting that information. Instead, the district court misstated the purpose for the request as an attempt to produce character evidence at trial. That simply was not the intent. The intent was to obtain information to conduct an effective cross-examination.
What questions on cross-examination were would you have wished to have pursued that this precluded?
Good question. You know, and that depends on the information that we would have obtained, which at this point is difficult to know. I anticipate that what we would have obtained would have been information that would have shown, as in this case, that Dr. Jimenez has performed multi-level disfusion operations on other patients that were not medically justified or in which the patients were worse off after the operation.
Would that be limited to the medical area that he practiced in? The physical area, the number of operations, or were you...
That these operations were primarily conducted there in that area.
Well, then if you got the you were seeking the names of these parties?
No. No, we were not. We excluded that information from our request. We excluded all privileged information from our request.
And so all you wanted to know is numbers?
Numbers and details regarding the operations, and we also requested information about complaints that might have been made, directives from the facilities to him regarding these operations.
Counsel, setting aside whether that's protected information, setting aside that issue,
yes.
Wouldn't the evidence be extrinsic under Evidence Rule 608 anyway for purposes of impeachment?
No, I don't think so, because the impeachment would have gone to his opinion as to the necessity of this operation.
Then it didn't go to impeachment. It went to the very issue of whether the surgery itself was necessary.
Exactly. In his opinion as to whether it was necessary.
Isn't the chain of reasoning, though, that other operations were not necessary, therefore there's an inference that this operation was not necessary? Isn't that the chain of reasoning that you're relying on?
Well, that inference certainly can be made, but the primary reason for obtaining this information would be to impeach his testimony that this particular operation was necessary.
Because he doesn't know what is or isn't necessary?
Yes, and because he takes an unusually or an excessively aggressive approach towards performing these operations.
And again, what questions were you prevented from asking on cross?
Well, we would have asked him, isn't it true, doctor, that he performed surgery in June of 2010 involving a multi-level disfusion operation when the medical records did not justify it for these reasons? He went ahead and performed the surgery, and after the surgery, that patient was worse off, similar to Ms. Moreno.
But aren't you getting a trial within a trial? Because how are you going to show that they weren't necessary?
We would have to obtain the medical records to show that.
And then get another expert?
And we would use an expert to review those as well.
And how is that not extrinsic evidence?
Well, If, when we get to the point of bringing in another expert to do that, yes, that would be extrinsic evidence. Our primary focus at this stage, keep in mind, this is simply a ruling on discovery. We were not debating whether or not the evidence was admissible at trial. We were simply at the discovery stage. That very issue was dealt by this court in Stetson versus Silverman. In that case, the link between the discovered information and the ultimate use at trial was much more tenuous than what we had here.
You had an expert at trial.
Yes, we did.
And what did that expert say with respect to the necessity?
Well, the expert completely contradicted Dr. Jimenez's opinion that the operation was necessary, testified that it was unjustified and inappropriate.
So you got that in, and the trier of fact heard from an expert that this was not necessary, right? And what
yes.
was the profile on your expert?
He's an experienced neurosurgeon who has many years of practice in conducting disfusion operations and in medical review. He's a teacher with teaching privileges both at Creighton and now at the University of Wisconsin.
So was he part of the CBS study?
No.
So his is this coincidence that he was at Wisconsin?
Right. Right. Yeah. He had nothing to do with the study and wasn't aware of it.
I presume you had the opportunity to depose Dr. Jimenez?
Yes, we did.
And did you have the opportunity to ask him how many of these operations he had performed?
No, we didn't know about the operations when we took the deposition, which was a year before we knew about this.
And did you seek to redepose after you learned about information?
Yes, we asked to continue the trial to obtain additional information. The court denied our motion. My time is up, so I simply ask that the court consider that this was not a question of admissibility at trial, but involved the issue of whether or not this information was simply discoverable. I would ask that the court to review the case of Stetson versus Silverman. Certainly, under that case, we were entitled to obtain this discovery. We are asking that the court reverse, remand the case for a new trial, that it be ordered to be tried in front of the different judge. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court.
We will give you 5 minutes, even though I think
I think we
ate into that.
I appreciate that. I want to talk about the fact that the clear evidence in this case shows that there was no injury caused by this accident to the plaintiff's neck. The court's findings in that regard were clearly wrong. It's key finding was number 5 under its conclusions, where the court stated that the medical providers, plaintiff's medical providers, treated her neck continuously after the accident. That's simply clearly wrong. Dr. Holloway didn't treat the neck. In fact, he cleared the neck from any issue. He treated the thoracic spine, and a couple of months later, because that spine, that part of the spine didn't get better, he referred her back to Dr. Jimenez. The judge also, in one of the facts supporting his findings, talked about the fact that there was strong neck pain experienced by plaintiff during physical therapy. And that finding also, or that conclusion, is also clearly wrong. There is one reference in 17 visits to that physical therapist to neck pain, and that's on February 25th. And on that same report, there's a section called Location of Pain. And you find that section in every one of the reports for those 17 visits. And never on this report or any of the other reports is there any reference to location of pain being the neck. In fact, as you got to the end of physical therapy, there was improvement in the thoracic spine, and in fact, the physical therapist thought she had normal range of motion and suggested further physical therapy. So except for that one reference to that pain and physical therapy, and then there was one instance of numbness and tingling. You know, Dr. Jimenez saw her first the day after surgery, and the tests there, all the tests for myelopathy were normal. There was normal range of motion. There was no neck pain. And the impression was thoracic pain. And we moved that ahead then from January until May when Dr. Jimenez, when she was referred back to him. And in that first visit, the same exam took place. No numbness, no tingling, no neck pain, normal range of motion. And then somehow we leap from that visit on the 5th of May to the 17th of May. In 12 days, we get to a visit that's entitled surgical evaluation. And there's the first time there's any numbness or tingling complaint, first time there's any balance issues complained about. And we launch from there to June 8th, which is the day of surgery. But what's key there is that Dr. Jimenez and his staff did a pre-surgical evaluation, found no numbness or tingling, stated nothing about any balance issues, no neck pain, normal range of motion, yet launched into a three-level cervical fusion. A surgery that the plaintiff stated Dr. Jimenez had scared her into taking because he was told her that there was a potential for paralysis. And then we need to look at the same deposition that Charles referred to of Dr. Jimenez. Long before his surgery was called into question, there were two things in that regard. He said the more likely history would have been her complaints at the time of the accident about neck pain, of which there were none. And then he also said that I need more detail to relate the symptoms of the neck to the accident. And he stated at the time of trial that he hadn't gotten any further detail. So, Your Honors, we'd ask that we tell you that the medical bills and the pain and suffering part of this neck surgery should not have been considered by the court. They should have been disregarded. And we ask this court to reverse for a new trial in that regard.
And you can see that a clearly wrong standard applies to
yes.
this.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Meister, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. If it pleases the court, counsel, I'm Mike Meister. I represent the appellee in this case. I found it interesting during the arguments of my esteemed colleagues that they never talk about the standard review in this case, which is can't change a fact decision by a fact finder unless it's clearly wrong, and two, you look at discovery issues on an abuse of discretion standard, and you have to show what your substantial right is that you were denied.
I guess I did hear Mr. Olson just refer to the standard of review.
Just that he conceded that it has to be clearly wrong. That's true, and he did that at the very end once prompted. However,
well, he mentioned it at the outset, too.
Well, I must have missed it,
all right.
Judge Castle. I apologize for that, and I apologize to Mr. Olson for that. I did also find interesting, though, that your question to Mr. Campbell about my position that they lack standing. In the Schrope case, which Judge Girard authored for the court back in 2011, there's a specific statement in that case that says, we note that some federal courts have recognized a limited exception to these general principles and permitted appeal by a party under the collateral order doctrine from an order denying discovery from a non-party in an ancillary proceeding. But we need not decide the applicability of that principle here, because that case didn't address the case that we have here, which is that ancillary proceeding. You'll note the Region West Medical Center, who opposed the subpoena, isn't here. They weren't made party to the appeal. They weren't made party to anything. What they're complaining about is, I can't get the records from Region West Medical Center on all of your surgeries, and I need to look at all of your surgeries in order to determine if the surgery my client had was fair. And that's really what they're arguing. What they're saying is, I want to look at everything else. A question I think was Judge Connolly asked also about the geography of the area. Dr. Jimenez testified he was a sole practitioner in Scott's Bluff. He covers from North Platte to Eastern Wyoming. The article that is, if you read that article, it's a hatchet job. And it's absolutely outrageous that they got away with it, but they did. It's all about innuendo. It's about supposition. He did 325 surgeries, the way the article wrote, from January 1st, 2011 to December 31st, 2012. Well, if you actually work that out, he did one surgery every other day for 2 years as a sole practitioner in an area that covers the western half of Nebraska and a good portion of eastern Wyoming. So it's really, when you look at the numbers, if you looked at Omaha and you looked at a practice of four neurosurgeons and they're doing two surgeries a week per person, they're probably doing the exact same number. So these numbers are just, they're just smoke and mirrors, and that's what they're doing to try and destroy. You note in my brief that I really kind of hammered at the frivolity of this. And I think it is frivolous. Judge Lipstube made very reasoned points on every single point regarding the facts. He explained, he did everything they asked him to do in terms of explaining why he discounted Dr. Talen, why he accepted Dr. Jimenez. This is not a fender bender. This was a case where a volunteer fireman is flying down a road, hits a county handy bus hard enough that it shoots my client out a window and into the street. I mean, this is not some small case. This was a large accident. The county driver for the handy bus said the guy from the fire department was going like the Dickens. And we're not sure what the Dickens is, but he was flying hard enough when he hit that county handy bus. He literally shot my client out of the vehicle. The facts are just absolutely square on the appellee's position. She's a 62-year-old woman. She has been waiting for justice, and justice keeps getting pushed down the road and pushed down the road. And as I was preparing for the case, and I had encouraged this court to take a hard stand and look at the frivolity of this appeal, I found a case from 1923, McCrae v. Wolf, 109 Nebraska 796.
Is that in your brief?
It is.
Oh, okay.
But the language is beautiful, though, and I'd like to state it out loud. And that language is this. And it's discussing the penalty provision in work comp, and that's kind of what I encouraged you to look at in terms of creating an appropriate sanction in this case. The provision for penalty was placed in the statute evidently with the object not only to induce prop payments after the award has been finally established, but in case the award is contested, to compel prompt action on the part of the defendant in making his defense, and to defeat frivolous delays and chronic procrastinations often occurring in the course of legal proceedings. And when any of these conditions are found to exist, the penalty should be promptly imposed. And
well,
I would argue...
to what penalty do you refer?
Again, that's 48.125. It's discussing 48.125 as it existed in 1923. But the court is talking about, in that case, the inequality between an employee and an employer and how that employer can hold the money back and make the employee's life miserable. Well, in this case, what we have is with a subdivision who doesn't like the result. They don't like the fact that the judge ruled against them, and so they appeal it. There is no basis for any of the issues that face this court. Two of them are fact-based issues. Two of them are abuse of discretion issues. The third one is also abuse of discretion. I don't think anybody addressed it, but that was the motion to continue. But again, abuse of discretion. There's been no showing of any impact of the substantial right of the defendants or appellants in this case.
Have you moved for attorney's fees?
I have not moved for attorney's fees specifically in this court. I did mention it in my brief, but I don't think that's sufficient. I don't think that's sufficient. I think, as an officer of the court, I have an obligation to this institution to make sure it is treated properly and treated with the respect it's due. And I don't bring appeals that I don't think I have merit. And I will send those off to other attorneys who may take those cases and bring them up here. I don't do that. I think that we, as practitioners, have an obligation to the court to be honest with our clients straight up and say, look, you got nothing here. These are fact questions. We lost. We have to accept that. But we want to hold our money for another year. We don't want to give it to the plaintiff. So let's just sit back and keep it. And the only way it's going to stop, the only way that kind of stuff is going to stop, is if this court takes a strong position and issues a strong sanction in that regard. Now, that being said, I realize there's no answer to that question I asked earlier about denied discovery.
Isn't your real quarrel here with the statute that does not require political subdivisions to supersede judgments? Isn't that, doesn't this belong in the legislative arena? Because if it weren't a political subdivision, they'd either have to supersede, that is, post enough to cover the interest, or you could enforce the judgment, even despite the pendency of the appeal. But because they're political subdivisions, the legislature say they don't have to supersede. Isn't that the real quarrel?
No. No, it is not. They could have easily not appealed this case, paid the judgment at the time we'd be done. But instead, they decided to opt to bring up fact questions for which they're not clearly wrong, and there's well-reasoned discussion by the trial judge. They brought up questions that involve abuse of discretion, which they still have yet to show what substantial right has been impacted by them. I mean, the problem that you have is as its own branch, as a judicial branch, and as I often see, the court will pull cases up to regulate its caseload. Well, part of the reason you have to regulate that caseload is because of cases like this plug in your docket. And the only way you clear that up and get that docket taken care of is you tell lawyers, doggone it, we're done. We're not putting up with this nonsense anymore. You guys need to address these issues on appeal with the same fervor you address them when you go to court.
Mr. Meister,
yes,
please don't refer to the court as you guys. That is offensive to us.
I didn't even realize I did that. I guess I'm fired up on this issue.
Mr. Meister, how do you think that this argument that you're making fits into our jurisprudence on what is a frivolous position or a frivolous argument? Are you asking us to extend our jurisprudence?
No, I think it fits squarely within the jurisprudence that's currently in existence.
All right.
Are there any other questions? Again, I apologize for you guys. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? We apparently will have no rebuttal, so we will go on to the next case of the day, which is Stevens versus Stevens.